The return of our favorite car gurus, Jamie and John. There's a lot of news in the automotive world right now. Tesla has just announced that the first of its much-anticipated Model 3 cars rolled off the assembly line last Friday. And Volvo announced that it is moving dramatically away from the internal combustion engine, that all of its new vehicles will either be electric or hybrid starting in 2019. Meantime, American automakers are closely monitoring the Trump administration to see if it will impose tariffs on imported steel and aluminum. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll discuss these developments and more with Jamie Page Deaton, automotive editor for U.S. News & World Report, and John Paul, the car doctor with AAA Northeast. What are your questions? What do you want to know about buying, selling, maintaining, or fixing your vehicle? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Both Tesla and Volvo grabbed worldwide headlines last week. Meantime, millions of Americans are piling into the family car and hitting the road for their summer vacation. Joining me today to talk about these things and all things automotive, Jamie and John. Jamie Page Deaton is the automotive editor for U.S. News and World Report. She joins us from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio. And joining us from right here in our Portland studio, John Paul. He is AAA's car doctor and senior manager of public affairs for AAA Northeast. As always, we want to hear from you. Are you excited about the new Tesla Model 3? What about the Mercedes electric concept car? Or are you just weighing whether to buy new or used a regular car? Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Regular listeners will know that I start by asking each of you what you've been driving, because each of you get to have a different car. Is it every week or every 2 weeks as part of being an automotive journalist? Jamie, is it every week or every 2 weeks?
It's every week.
Wow. And so what have you been driving and what do you like?
This week I am in the Lexus RX 450H, which is the hybrid version of the RX, sort of a two-row midsize SUV. You see these all over the place. They're ubiquitous, and there's, you know, a good reason. It's kind of, you know, it's the best kind of car in that you can forget about it. You know, if you aren't really a gearhead, you just want something that's very quiet and comfortable for commuting and luxurious and not too expensive, it's great. But what's really struck me about it is it's a hybrid. And honestly, if it hadn't had a hybrid badge on it, it would be really hard for me to tell. And that's true of the last hybrid I drove as well, which is a Chevy Malibu hybrid. Hybrids have come so far, you don't have the kind of weird feeling or generative brakes that you used to have even just, you know, 2-3 years ago. These are, you know, getting good gas mileage, driving just like regular cars.
What kind of gas mileage do they get?
So the RX hybrid that I'm getting now, I'm averaging 31.6 miles per gallon, which for an SUV of this size is pretty gosh darn good. I got 37 in the Malibu hybrid without babying it or anything like that. I probably could do better with both of them if I really wanted to hypermile, but I don't. I want to drive normally. So being able to get that kind of mileage without having to change my driving habits and not having it feel, you know, weird, having it drive like a conventional car with really not a lot of sacrifice in terms of power or braking feel. Like, that to me is just a win-win.
John, what about you? What have you been driving and what are you excited about?
Well, I don't know how excited I can be about it, but I was driving the Honda Odyssey minivan, the 2018 model, and they've done some changes. It still looks like a minivan, but it has a lot of really unique features. Like the second row seats actually slide side to side, so you can, if you decide you want a center aisle to get into the third row, you can do it that way. You can slide the seat over, all the way over to one side, so you can get an easy exit from one of the power doors. This one was pretty well equipped. It had a lot of options in it. It had a couple of unique options. One, it had an infrared rear-facing camera in the cabin, so you could see if you left your kids back there, for instance, and you know, you could see a little infrared image of them. It also had a push-to-talk intercom system. So if you have kids that are a little bit older that are listening to music, because it also had a built-in Wi-Fi hotspot, or they were watching a movie. So none of that old days of having to, like, look at license plate numbers and things to, you know, keep yourself busy out on the road.
Or talk.
Or talk, for instance. But if just like if you're on an airplane and the pilot wants to interrupt while you're listening to something, you push a button and you go, excuse me, calm down back there, whatever you want to do. And it actually goes right through the headphones inside the vehicle. So that was pretty unique. And also, if you don't use the headphones, there was actually a true intercom system. So if they're, you know, third row passengers, you push the intercom button and you don't have to yell back and forth between the third seat.
Oh, my goodness. Now, is the Honda Odyssey the one with the built-in vacuum cleaner?
Oh, it does. And that was one of the things that I was at the beach with it for a few days. So, of course, beach sand everywhere. And it was actually pretty handy. Just, you know, start the car up, pull the hose out, start to vacuum away. The hose is long enough where you can get right from the front seat all the way to the back, zip it all up, close it up. And
does it have a microwave or a popcorn maker?
They were thinking about it, but no, but that it wouldn't need much more than that. It really, I mean, for a vehicle to be able to carry families, carry people, carry stuff, and also, and sort of this is the telling piece of any vehicle you carry anything, yes, you can put a 4x8 sheet of plywood in the back of it. So, you know, it's plenty wide, it's plenty tall, the third row seat folds completely flat, so you have ton of cargo room. It really, really a pretty unique vehicle.
And Jamie, this is what you're always talking about, how much variety there is, how there is something for everybody these days. I want to talk about the big news, because this, it seems as you all have impeccable timing. Whenever we book you to be on the program, something really big happens to the automotive industry. We'll start with Volvo's announcement, Jamie. Explain to us what it exactly they've committed to and how big of a deal is this really?
Well, what Volvo announced is that after the 2019 model year, they would no longer be building cars that only had an internal combustion engine. So every car that they produced was going to be electrified, either with a hybrid powertrain or a purely electric powertrain. Now, one thing, this gathered a lot of news, a lot of it incorrect, because a lot of the headlines said Volvo kills the gasoline engine, which is not at all what they said, because you've got to remember a hybrid car has a gasoline engine. That's what makes it a hybrid. It's got gasoline and electric power. But in terms of how big a deal this is, you know, this is in line with an announcement that Volvo made last year where they said that by 2020, their goal was to have no death in any Volvo car. And so what's this really is, you know, to my mind, a step along actually the path to that goal. I think, you know, Volvo has realized that there's a lot of interest in cars with some electrification in there. A lot of the technical hurdles have been overcome. You know, if you're talking about hybrids like I was a couple minutes ago, they're not strange to drive as a consumer. They're more and more like a regular car. But what it comes down to is, you know, for Volvo to hit this goal of having no deaths or serious injuries in a Volvo by 2020, they're going to have to get their systems to be a lot more automated and have their driving be a lot more autonomous. And that is a lot easier to do the more electrification you put into the powertrain, because the computer can then control things a lot more easily and a lot more seamlessly. So this was really taken and written about as a, you know, this is a win for environments. This is Volvo taking on Tesla. But at the same time, you know, this is really just a step on the road of making their other pledge that they made last year to be a little bit more safety minded. And that's what really, you know, to my mind, what this is about. And the thing to remember, too, you know, this is not out of character for Volvo. I mean, since Volvo's history, they've really been at the forefront of a lot of automotive innovations. I mean, Volvo invented the 3-point seatbelt that we all wear and has saved countless lives. And they patented it and then just gave it out to everybody to use because they cared about, you know, saving lives.
Go ahead.
Well, it'll just be interesting to see if they hit this. I don't think they'll have a lot of problem with it because they got a lot of capital. But we'll have to see how consumers respond.
Well, I was going to say, it's interesting because Volvo was a little late to the hybrid market.
Yeah, they have been a little bit late. But at the same time, you know, it's were they late or were they letting other people spend the money and make the mistakes? I mean, I think you could probably make a case for you know, both of those. And I will say, too, you know, the last couple of Volvos that I've been in, you know, the new XC90, the S90, the V90, those have all been just very, very good cars with a lot to offer consumers, often at a lower price than competitors. I mean, the S90 is a large luxury car and one of the least expensive ones in the class, with a high level of automation, you know, a gorgeous interior, excellent technology. I mean, what I love about it is, you know, you can hit a microphone button and then just say, I'm hot. and the car will automatically turn the air conditioner down for you a little bit. Or you can say, hey, turn on my seat warmer, and it will. And so that's a level of automation I think consumers are going to really kind of take with and run. And really, if Volvo is able to deliver that level of refinement and comfort, you know, in a hybrid or electric powertrain, they're really going to, I think, please a lot of potential buyers there.
John, I'm reading that this announcement from Volvo came the day before France said that it would ban gasoline engines in new cars starting in 2040. 2040 seems like a long way away, but is this an aggressive commitment by the country of France or not so much?
I mean, to completely ban gasoline engines, I think it is. But to do a hybrid and even to use Volvo's example, once you get the packaging down, once you kind of think of a hybrid drivetrain as really a gasoline engine, an electric motor, and a battery pack, and then you just kind of upsize it and downsize it to make it work. So to be able to put that across all of their models, I don't think will be difficult. To go with the idea of complete electrification for a city, a little bit more difficult, and a little bit more difficult because you also have to consider the recharging aspect of it. And the problem is the infrastructure there to be able to charge up all these electric cars? And, you know, we I think we've talked about this before. You know, you look across the country during air conditioner season, there's brownouts and in some cases complete blackouts because the grid suffers so much because it's not really up to the capability. So to say that there's no gasoline engines, you know, in the city of Paris is one thing to say it. It's a second thing to be able to support what the next alternative is, which would be electric cars. So,
Jamie, do you expect other European countries to be following France's lead?
Yeah, I think Sweden's already talking about it, which may have something to do why Volvo is ahead on this. But I mean, to John's earlier point, too, I mean, for this for Volvo, you've got to remember, too, that Volvo doesn't have as many models as a lot of other automakers do. You look at the size of the lineup at, say, Chevy or Toyota, there would be a much bigger engineering lift in order to get hybrid or electric powertrains into all of those models. Volvo has a very small lineup. They only use a couple of platforms for all of their models. So this is a pretty easy engineering feat, you know, for Volvo to accomplish compared to like what Toyota would have to do. But, you know, to John's point, you know, there's the electric vehicles aren't just about developing the vehicles. It's about developing the infrastructure as well, which is why I think we're going to be entering now into this kind of mid gray area where you have a lot of hybrids or extended range hybrids before you have a full on onslaught of purely electric vehicles, because there's just not the infrastructure for everybody to be out there driving a Tesla or a Chevy Bolt or something like that.
Well, speaking of electric vehicles, and Jamie just used the word, John, Tesla, on Friday, supposedly, Tesla rolled the first of its Model 3 off the assembly line. I've noticed some automotive writers saying, where are the pictures? But how significant is this? Last time you were on the air here, Tesla's stock was skyrocketing, valued higher than General Motors. That has fallen, yet the Model 3 is now coming out.
Maybe. Yeah, I think that's one of the interesting things is, you know, where it's really going to go. And, you know, the Model 3, you know, certainly is possible. You look at the Chevrolet Bolt, which, you know, is pretty comparative with the Model 3. So I think they can definitely do it. It's whether Elon Musk continues to put the capital into the company and whether he has the investments to do it. I mean, with the Model 3, I think I lost track at 450,000 people put $1,000 up to buy one.
Pre-order it.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, someone I know actually has their name in for two of them because they have had two Teslas in the past. So I think it's there, but it's, you know, years ago I kind of looked at Tesla and back then Fisker, another car company that was going to build kind of cool electric cars. And I looked at it and I said, you know, maybe history is going to turn around a little bit and say, back in the 50s, it was Tucker, a very innovative car company. They built some really cool stuff. It was a rear engine, big car with, you know, it had a third swiveling headlight in the front. And it had built in jacks and it used an air cooled engine. It didn't use a radiator. And it was kind of a cool car and they made like 100 of them. But they had a really good time. It was a really good story. And at the end of the day, I wonder, you know, I was looking at that and going, I think Fisker and Tesla may turn out the same way. Fisker sort of did. There's faded away for the most part, coming back a little bit. Tesla's still, you know, continuing on, and they're building some very unique and innovative vehicles. I saw their Model X a couple of times while I was on vacation. You know, people who have them love them. The person I know who has one, he wanted a luxury American car that was fun to drive. He drove a Cadillac. He had a Cadillac once. He had a Lincoln once. He didn't care for either of them that much. And he went for the Tesla. And he said, you know, it does everything I want to do. And, yeah, I had to be able to adjust my driving habits a little bit, but it's worked out for me. I'm, you know, mostly where I go is within the 250-mile range, so it works out.
Jamie, you have thoughts on Tesla's Model 3 that supposedly is going to retail for $35,000?
Yeah, but don't forget there's tax credits too. So a lot of people won't end up paying $35,000. But the other thing to remember is that a lot of people also won't get the tax credit because there's only a certain number of those. So the first buyers will get the tax credit, but later buyers won't. Here's the challenge with Tesla. I think building a car is really, really hard, to put it in super simple terms. And Tesla's discovered that. They've had a number of quality issues with the Model X where the doors don't work. Which is a pretty significant thing to have in a car. That said, they've also achieved some incredible feats of automotive engineering. So it really just comes down to, can they get consistent about quality in their vehicles? And when you're talking about a Model 3 buyer versus a Model X or a Model S buyer, you know, a lot of Model S buyers are very high income, high net worth. They're early adopters. They're buying this car to make a statement. When you have that many people putting pre-orders in on the Model 3, you know, a lot of them are going to be coming over from Honda and Toyota, and they're going to expect that car to run like a Honda or a Toyota. And if they don't get that, they're going to abandon them. So they really need to make sure that the quality is there when you're building a mass market car. Because for an early adopter, a lot of the issues that Tesla has had, you know, they can kind of put it across as, well, you know, these are quirks, and they can fix them with an over-the-air software update. And it's really not a big deal. And look, it's just so cool. But if, you know, you can't get to work in your, you know, $35,000 car, and this is something you traded in your Honda or you sold your Honda and then bought, that's going to be a little bit of a different issue, I think, for a lot of the buyers. So I'll be really interested to see just how the quality holds up for the Model 3, if they're able to hit their production targets, keep quality high and consistent, and what the reliability of the Model 3 is.
John?
To Jamie's point a little bit, you're right on the mark about the Model 3 and the buyer it's going to attract. Many, many years ago, Cadillac tried to go with an entry-level Cadillac. And I remember working next door to a Cadillac dealership, and the owner of the dealership said to me, when people that bought Chevrolets for whatever they cost at the time, $10,000, and they stepped up to buy this entry-level Cadillac, and they expected it to be the perfect car, and it wasn't. It was just a car. And I think people are going to look at the model. If the Model 3 isn't perfect coming off the assembly line, they're going to be really, really disappointed with it. And I think that's where Tesla may really suffer. The Model X buyer, the Model S buyer, they also have other cars. So that's part of it, too. And, yeah, so it has to go into the shop, and they come and get it, and it's not that inconvenient. You know, you're already losing the free charging with the Model 3, so are you going to still see the same thing, that someone's going to show up with a trailer, pick up your car, and bring it back to you at the end of the day? Maybe not with the Model 3. Well, it's too early to tell.
If you'd like to join the conversation, if you have questions about your own car, our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Wayne Fleet, the kind of school that thinks good questions are at least as important as right answers. Learn more at waynefleet.org. And WEX, providing global payment solutions for the fleet, travel, and health industries. Career opportunities at WEXINC.com.
On the next Radio Lab.
Going to Galapagos is like going to Mecca.
Is the place that taught us about evolution.
Green mangroves, black lava flows, pink flamingos.
Wow. Now a harbinger for the end of nature.
We're radically remaking the world.
That forest was 100% gone.
And how far are we willing to go to save it?
We're God. We might as well get good at it.
Galapagos on the next Radio Lab.
And you can hear Radio Lab this evening at 11 o'clock.
I'm Corva Coleman, here to talk about change. You know, when I first started out, I wanted to be a lawyer, maybe even go into politics, but then something changed. Okay, the truth is, I basically failed out of law school. Did you know that your car can change, too? It can change into Morning Edition, all things considered. And wait, wait, don't tell me. All you have to do is donate it to this station. And here's how.
Just visit mainpublic.org and click on support.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, our car experts are with me to answer your car buying, fixing, and safe driving questions. John Paul is AAA's car doctor and senior manager of public affairs for AAA Northeast. Jamie Page Deaton, automotive editor for U.S. News. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Before we go to listener questions, I have a couple more for you all. I'm going to start with you, John. It is vacation season. What are the reminders? What do you want people to think about before they pile the family in the car and head to northern Maine or somewhere else that's wonderful?
AAA, the three main reasons AAA goes out for road service calls: flat tires or blown out tires, dead batteries, and people locking their keys in the car. So you can eliminate a lot of that by making sure your tires are in really good shape, they're properly inflated, have the battery tested. Although batteries work hard in the cold weather, they actually tend to fail in hot weather. So the heat actually causes problems with the chemistry inside the battery. So a very hot string of hot days can cause battery failure as well. Here in the Northeast, a battery lasts about 5 years or so. In places like Arizona and Central Florida, it's closer to 2 or 3 years. So heat can be, if you have a battery that's 5 or 6 years old and it's been okay, leaving the car in a parking lot on a 90-degree day could end that battery's life. So make sure the battery's in good shape. Make sure the tires are in good shape. There's 6 or 7 vital fluids under the hood: engine coolant, oil, power steering, and so forth. If you haven't changed them, at least make sure they're topped off and they're in good shape. So before you head on a trip, make sure the engine coolant is full, the oil's full. Check all the rest of the fluids that you know how to check. Make sure they're all full. It's easy to do. Carry an extra quart of oil, some extra, if you're planning a long trip, an extra container of pre-mixed engine coolant and water that comes 50-50 mix now. It's really easy to do. And make sure your spare tire is in good shape and you have a jack and a lug wrench. And if your car happens to have one of those locking wheel lugs, the little tool that you use to get the wheel lug off, sometimes we go out and we do a road service call. We get out there and we say, oh, where's the wheel lock key? And people look at us and they go, I don't know. And so now all of a sudden the car has to be towed someplace where that can be removed. So making sure your spare is in good shape and your jack is in good shape and all that sort of stuff. And a lot of cars today, right from the factory, don't even have spare tires, which is always a concern too. But if you are heading out, make sure all that stuff is in good shape. It's just the easiest thing to do.
And every time you lock your door, make sure the keys are with you.
With you, in your hand. It's so easy to, and this is when it happens, and I work in a parking lot with a lot of people in it, and as soon as you add that one extra thing to your routine in the morning.
When you're on vacation, you're not in routine.
That's right. So usually you get your bag, your lunch, whatever the case is, and all of a sudden, in this day I got a cup of coffee, and I left my keys on the seat, closed the door, locked the door. So especially if you're traveling as a family, have someone else carry a backup set of keys.
Okay, and Jamie, you all like to do best fill-in-the-blank at U.S. News and World Report. I noticed your most recent one is best used car financing deals. Before you tell me which the best are, I want to ask you, how does one these days make the calculation? Do I buy a new car or a certified pre-owned car? Because, boy, every year there's so much more on cars that it seems that, unless the price is dramatic, that the new car is the way to go.
Yeah, I mean, this is a calculation that there are no hard and fast rules. Everybody just has to figure this out for themselves. If you want, the latest new car technology and you can pay for it, by all means, go for a new car. If you're willing to go for something that's maybe 2-3 years old, I think a certified pre-owned car is a great way to get it, because these are cars that are low mileage. Generally, they can only be a couple of years old. And generally, for the most part, most automakers get these cars when they come in off of leases. And what we're actually starting to notice now is that there is a little bit of a glut entering the CPO marketplace as cars come off of leases. The popularity of leasing over the past couple of years has really skyrocketed. And now the crest of that wave of leasing, they're starting to be turned back in. So you're going
to
see.
And when you say CPO, you mean certified pre-owned, right?
Certified pre-owned, which is different from a regular used car. I mean, a regular used car, anybody can sell their car, and guess what? It's a used car. A certified pre-owned car is a car that the automaker has that it has been previously owned, usually, like I said, on a lease. But the automaker takes it, they put it through an inspection process, they fix anything, and they recondition anything that might need to be reconditioned, and then they sell it to you with additional warranty protections, which is the real appeal of, I think, certified pre-owned cars is, you know, you don't take on quite as much risk as you would with a typical used car. Now, that said, there are some brands where, you know, buying a CPO car may not actually be worth it because you're paying a little bit extra money for a long-term warranty, and cars from those brands tend not to break down. So you're paying for something that you may not actually use. But there's another piece of the calculation that I think people miss when they're debating new versus used, and that's the loan rate that you can get between a new car and a used car. So typically, new car loan rates are a little bit lower than used car loan rates, simply because a used car loan represents a little bit more risk to the lender. So if you're looking at just price, a used car on price alone looks like a better deal. But if you actually look at your total cost when you add in financing, there are some cases where a new car, because if you qualify for a lower, you know, promotional rate, you can actually end up saving money overall, even though you're paying a higher, you know, sticker price for the car, you're financing at a lower rate. So your overall costs are a little bit lower. Now, one kind of exception to that is an additional benefit of CPO cars is that automakers often offer financing deals on them. And these deals are rarely, you know, the 0% financing that you see on new cars. But we saw this month that a lot of automakers were offering 1.9% financing, and even a couple were offering 0.99% financing, which is incredibly low for a pre-owned car.
So yeah, I'm looking at your article right now, BMW, Honda, top of the list.
Yeah. So if you take the price cut that you get by going for a CPO BMW or a CPO Honda, and you qualify for this lower loan rate, you'll end up saving a lot of money and only getting technology that's maybe a year or two old. And honestly, too, you know, if you can look at the model that you're considering, if it's only 2 to 3 years old, you know, there may not be any differences between the CPO version and the one that's currently on the new lot if the automaker hasn't refreshed it or updated it at all. So they can actually end up being a pretty good deal. Of course, you know, I've got to say these loans are really only for people with excellent credit. Not everybody's going to qualify for 0.99% on a CPO loan. But if you do have really good credit, chances are that you're a fairly frugal person and a certified pre-owned car might appeal to you.
We have an email here from Mary. My car has one of the recalled airbags. However, there are no replacement bags available at this time. I'm concerned that I'm putting my family and myself at risk by continuing to drive my car. Unfortunately, I can't go buy a new car, and I'm not sure the car will also have a defective airbag. I understand that moisture was a factor in the failure of these airbags in Florida. Maine summers are typically very humid. How can consumers protect themselves? Should safeguards be put in place to ensure that the millions of consumers are not put in harm's way by defective automobile products? So, John Paul, first off, what's your advice to someone in this pickle? They know that they have a defective airbag, but they're not able to replace it right away.
Don't hit anything.
No moose or deer?
The expression was great when I said that, by the way. It is really a difficult situation. The amount of injuries that have happened because of defective airbags, with the exception of the very first generation Honda products, is a very, very low percentage number. So yes, people have been hurt, people have been killed, but it's a very, very low percentage number. The other thing is, most of us go through our lives without ever seeing an airbag deployment, which is a great thing. So what can you really do? You have to wait for Takata, the airbag manufacturer, if they don't completely go out of business, or wait for that next company to come up with the replacement parts. Some vehicle manufacturers were authorizing disconnecting the airbag. So the problem with that is airbags in general provide about 10 to 15% additional safety benefit. So you can talk to the vehicle manufacturer. In some cases, they will disconnect the airbag. That will put you in a situation. So at least if you do hit something, a moose runs out in front of you, something, whatever the case is, and you got into that crash, at least you don't have to worry about getting injured by the airbag. Yeah, it is areas where it's hot and humid. So if you lived in the coast of Florida most of the time and, I don't know, the coast of someplace else in the summertime where it's hot and humid, that would be where the problem is, because it's actually the propellant that makes the airbag work. The heat and humidity affect it, and it causes deterioration of the part that holds the airbag in place, which is why the airbag literally leaves its perch, and that's how people get hurt. I cited the first-generation Hondas, the early-generation Hondas with the airbag recall, because they're so old at this point. They're saying that if the airbag deploys, there's a 50% chance that the drivers could get injured or killed. So if you own one of the early Hondas and you're just
late, when you say early, what years are we talking about?
I don't have it right off the top of my head, but I think it's late 90s, early 2000s maybe. But Honda's even gone to the point where they hired private investigators to try to find people that own these cars to get the airbags replaced in them. Someone I know that had an Audi with a defective airbag in it, Audi actually said to them, "We'll help you with your trade-in to get you out of this car that you're not comfortable with, to get you into a newer one." So I know they said they're not in a point to buy a new car, but maybe they could talk to the dealer and see if there is some assistance, you know, and they usually want to publicize those kind of things. So see if there is some other way to help them into another car. And in a lot of cases, the writer's correct that are they just putting the same airbag back in? In some cases, that actually was the case, figuring that in 10 years from now, they'll be able to figure it out. So it is a time issue. Time and age is what really causes the biggest problem. And we've never seen a recall like this. This is monumental. And how do we protect the consumer from it? When it's this broad, I don't know that there's a real good answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can I just hop in for a second? Because I was writing about this morning. So I actually have that, you know, there with this recall, you know, NHTSA estimates that it may eventually come to impact a quarter of the cars on the road in the United States. So a full 1/4 of the cars on the road. And the thing is, though, to remember, Mary, like, I understand that, you know, this is obviously, you know, very disconcerting, and you want to keep yourself and your family safe. But with this recall affecting, you know, 33 different automotive manufacturers, everybody from Honda on up to Ferrari is impacted by this recall. You know, a quarter of the cars on the road. NHTSA has confirmed 16 deaths related to this and 60 serious injuries. So when you think about how many cars are actually impacted and how many people have actually been seriously hurt, I mean, that is, you know, John was saying it was a low percentage. It is an extremely low percentage. And you have to think, you know, I know that a lot of the manufacturers have said, well, not a lot, but some of them have said, go ahead and disconnect the airbag. I would almost rather just take my chances with the airbag, because while you lose the risk from the airbag, you also potentially harming you, you also lose the protection that the airbag could give you if it wasn't, you know, if it works properly. So really, this really is a tough one. But just bear in mind the vast, you know, how many cars are impacted by this and how few people have hurt. And I realize that is, you know, cold comfort to the people who have been hurt and the families of those who have been killed by this. But this really is kind of, you know, a game of risk. I mean, you look at this and people are all worried about it. They're up in arms on it. But, you know, you're probably at greater risk, you know, if you own a swimming pool or if you have a gun in your house or something like that. So just keep those things in mind when you're evaluating what you want to do about this.
I had the chance to talk to Mark Rosekind, the former director of NHTSA, and I asked him whether he would recommend disconnecting the airbag, and he said absolutely not. He said even as dangerous potentially as they could be, the added safety benefit is there to keep it installed and keep it intact.
And it says National Transportation Safety Administration, right?
That is correct.
Okay. We'll go to David calling from Freeport. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, Jennifer and guests. Thank you for taking my call. I've been on hold long enough that I now have three questions.
Well, we have to go to break pretty soon, so quickly.
I'll be crisp. First of all, I wanted to mention that I have heard several articles, read and heard several reports regarding the vulnerability to hacking of new cars. And so it does cause me some concern in the idea of purchasing a new car and then having the hacking that I think the automotive industry has not taken seriously enough. The reason I originally called was I was curious about this new law, the law for 2040 in France, and I wonder whether, in fact, that in only gasoline or does it include diesel? Because there's been a significant effort, and fuel has always been an issue in Europe, especially in Western Europe, regarding the cost of fuel and attempts to switch over to diesel.
Jamie, do you know the answer is France saying all, including
diesel? All,
yeah,
I think it's all internal combustion engines, so that would be gas and diesel. I think I'm about 80% sure.
And
on
what
that.
About new cars getting hacked? How big of a concern is that?
You know, I've been to a couple of conferences where automakers do, you know, they say they're taking it very seriously. I think one of the reasons you don't hear about them taking it very seriously is because they don't want to panic people and don't want to put ideas into their head. I think, you know, the world that we live in right now is you just have to kind of assume that stuff you buy could potentially be hacked. It's just kind of a fact of life. I do know automakers are working to make their cars, you know, less hackable. But as always, you know, the guys in the white hats are always only, you know, a step behind the guys in the black hats. So I think it's definitely a concern. But I wouldn't list it under the concerns that would keep me up at night if I was buying a new car.
All right. And we do have our tech team on tomorrow, so we can ask them the same question. We do have to take another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Breakwater, curiosity for life. Learn more at their toddler, preschool, and kindergarten open house on July 15th, breakwaterlearning.org.
My first car was a green two-door Plymouth Satellite, and it was a tank. I mean, this thing was the size of a Winnebago. I'm Corva Coleman from NPR News, and I never did any maintenance on it, and it was rusty, and it looked horrible. But it was my first car. I drove it to high school. I drove it to college. Drove around with it with my first boyfriend. Yeah, that was a good car. Imagine turning that car into my favorite programs.
And to learn more, visit mainepublic.org and click on support. And join us after Maine Calling for the Commonwealth Club of California. Today's speaker, Benjamin Aaron Shapiro, American conservative political commentator, nationally syndicated columnist, author, radio talk show host, and attorney who will speak on the rules for debating the left. That's the Commonwealth Club of California coming up after Maine Calling here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, automotive news and answers to your automotive questions. With me today, Jamie Page Deaton, who is automobile editor for U.S. News and World Report. And John Paul is here in the studio with me. He's AAA's car doctor and senior manager of public affairs for AAA Northeast. If you'd like to join our conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Paul, who's calling from Cumberland. Hi, Paul. Go ahead.
Hello. I have a Nissan Leaf, which I absolutely love. It's a fully electric vehicle. And then I also have a Chevy Bolt, which is about a 40-mile electric car, and then it turns into an electric hybrid. And I'm super satisfied with them. I mean, they've been just fantastic. The Nissan Leaf is my favorite car ever, and I'm never going to go back to gasoline engines. I'm completely switched over. And I have solar panels that power my house now and my cars. So I haven't gone to a gas station in about 3 weeks so far this summer. And I'm just completely converted over. And like I said, I'll never go back to gasoline because I think the future is electric vehicles. And the technology is here. It's here today. And I'm just really excited. I mean, I'm going to save up for a Tesla, but I'm really happy with what I have so far.
Let me ask you this, Paul. Do you love your Nissan Leaf because you love the car, or do you love the idea of never going to the gas station?
I'd say both. It was a really, really well-designed car. It was one of the first cars that they designed from the ground up as an electric vehicle as opposed to taking an old model and just retrofitting it. So it was really designed well, and I love the car, but of course, you know, the idea of powering the car with solar power or clean electricity is really exciting also.
John, Paul, you were nodding when he was talking.
No, the Leaf is a great car, and you have to be the right person for the car. I commute about 100 miles each way, round trip back and forth to work, and the last two electric cars that I drove, fortunately, we have a charging station at work, but if we didn't, I couldn't make the round trip. So again, you have to be the right person for the right car. But I think the Leaf is a great car. When it first came out, I thought it was phenomenal. I thought it was really, really, earth-shattering because they said, well, it can do 100 miles an hour, it can carry five people, and it can go 100 miles between charges. I'm like, well, that's perfect. You know, you can't do all of them at the same time, but, you know, but at least you could do some of that. So, again, the Leaf's a great car. The Volt, the extended range electric car, the Volt is gives you that alternative. So if you wanted to leave Maine and drive to Connecticut, you could do it without any problem. Yeah, you stop and get gas once in a while, just like every other car.
Paul, thanks for your call. Our number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. We're going to go to Suzanne calling from New Hampshire. Hi, Suzanne. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, I'm visiting in New Hampshire, but I'm from California, and sort of piggybacking on the person, the previous caller, I'm one of the original Model S owners, and I love my car. I will never, ever go back to a combustion engine. I haven't bought gas in 4 years. And I think when I was listening to your station, what made me call was when you were talking about the electric vehicles and Tesla, I think the part that is being left out as an owner is it's got to be one of the best cars on the planet to drive. It's relaxing because there's no vibration from the engine. I plug it in at night. Every day it's full. I've driven it to Arizona. I drive it to the mountains. It's like a rocket ship because of the acceleration. So it's a wonderful car to drive, and I can't imagine that the 3 is going to not have any of those aspects. So,
all right. And how long ago did you buy it, Suzanne?
I've had it for 4 years.
Wow. Okay, Jamie, thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, the great thing about the Model 3 is it's going to have all of those things, you know, those things that, you know, where it's quiet and you don't have engine vibration because you don't have an engine. You plug it in at night and it's always full until you drive a couple hundred miles and then you have to plug it in again. But that, you know, you have to deal with any car. You always have to stop and top it off. But the thing is, too, I mean, a lot of owners, you know, can get that now as well with the Chevy Bolt with a B, not with a V, as the Volt, which Paul was talking about. One thing that impressed me about the Bolt was, and it's an all-electric car from Chevy. It was built from the ground up to be an electric car as well. You know, the acceleration that Suzanne was talking about, here you're in this little Chevy hatchback and you hit the accelerator pedal and you're knocked back. Not quite to the extent that you are with the, you know, ludicrous mode in the Model S, but for way more power at launch than you would expect because from a little Chevy hatchback, because you're not waiting for, you know, the gasoline engine to kind of power up. You have all that torque on demand. And so it really is, I think, you know, what Paul and what Suzanne are showing that, you know, when the early adopters get in and they say like, hey, this technology works, I'm not having to make as many compromises as I thought I would. That's what's really going to lead the way to widespread adoption for electric cars, again, provided that there's infrastructure for it as well. You know, Suzanne's obviously in a very different infrastructure landscape than we are in New Hampshire. You know, I live in New Hampshire. I would love to have an electric vehicle, and I probably could because I just, you know, basically drive, you know, from home, you know, to daycare and things like that, but I don't have a garage to plug it in. And it would take, you know, unless I got a charging station put in my house, you know, it would take about 8 hours to fully charge a car, which isn't that bad overnight. But at the same time, you know, I often do a lot of long drives and road trips. You know, if I was to go down to the garage where we have, you know, NEMPA meetings, I would have a problem. I mean, there's a reason that I don't get to test as many electric cars as John does, and that's because they don't have the range to make it to my house, and New Hampshire doesn't have the charging infrastructure that you see in other states. And I, you know, really would hate to think about what would happen if I, you know, took an electric car up north and, you know, on a drive up into the, up, you know, past the Notch in New Hampshire. So, I mean, it's one of those things where it's always so gratifying to hear the early adopters for this new technology, and it really is great. I think everybody who's driven an electric car could end up being a convert, as good as the technology is now. We've just got to get the infrastructure to follow up.
Yeah, thanks, Suzanne, for your call. And John, you said you have a charging station right at your workplace.
At work, we have one, and it's handy and convenient. But I have an app on my phone to pinpoint charging stations, and where I was on vacation last week, the nearest charging station was about 15 miles away. But if I went to the next bigger city, there was half a dozen charging stations. So a little bit easier to deal with. But yeah, charging off a 110 volt outlet from your home, the last electric car I had took 16 hours to recharge. So to go from almost zero, which it was when I brought it back home, to fully charge can be a challenge. So yeah.
So the bottom line is, right now, not for everybody, but boy, the technology is improving quickly.
Oh, it really is. And years ago, I actually owned an electric car. It was made by a company in Acton, Massachusetts, called the U.S. Electric Car Company. It was actually really a Renault LeCar that they put 16 golf cart batteries in it. It was dangerous. It was horrible. It smelled because it smelled like batteries charging all the time. It was a horrible car. But it was kind of unique, and the reason I bought it was I wanted to see what made electric cars work. And these cars were so basic, almost nothing made them work. So,
and we should note that you brought your wife with you today, and she's over there laughing.
Laughing, yeah.
We have a Facebook post, two posts from Mike. Are there any all-wheel, four-wheel drive hybrid cars or all-electric cars? And what do your guests think about the Honda Accord Hybrid and the Toyota Camry Hybrid? So, Jamie, I'll go to you. Are there any four-wheel drive hybrid cars or all-electric cars?
You can get, I think you can get all-wheel drive on the Toyota RAV4 Hybrid and on the Subaru XV Crosstrek Hybrid, if
okay.
they're still doing that one.
And what do you both think about the Honda Accord Hybrid and the Toyota Camry Hybrid?
I have not driven either of those.
I have driven the Accord Hybrid, different than the first generation Accord Hybrid, which almost didn't make a lot of sense. It was too expensive, and the fuel economy really wasn't that good. The new Accord Hybrid is actually a really nice car. I think it was up around 40-ish miles per gallon, maybe even a little bit higher. But you can almost do that with a conventional gasoline engine if you drive reasonably, depending on what the car is. But the Accord Hybrid, great, and I would assume the Camry Hybrid is the same.
Yeah, I would also just point out, Mike, we're currently getting ready to publish our Toyota Camry Hybrid review and ranking on usnews.com/cars, so you can see how it ranks there. I would also point out, too, you know, I was mentioned earlier in the show that I was testing the Chevy Malibu Hybrid, and I was getting about 37 miles to the gallon. And while it was, you know, a car that I wasn't really compromising on in terms of performance, I did think that for a hybrid, I expected better fuel economy. I mean, when you have, you know, hybrids that are getting, you know, 50 miles to the gallon, 37 starts to not seem that great. And, you know, I know plenty of gasoline engines that can get, you know, 42 miles to the gallon. So it's one of those things where, you know, when you're looking at a lot of these hybrids, I think people might actually be let down by the gas mileage if they don't look real closely before they buy.
Sure. We'll go to Neil, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Neil. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Hi, thank you. I guess you could say I'm like a petrol head and a little bit of a skeptic, and I just sort of had 3 points I wanted to raise, which is, I think you may have brushed on this, but the infrastructure, where 70% of the electricity we use in the United States is still on coal. So I have to raise the question, what are we really powering these cars with? And then second is sort of a bigger pet peeve, is that the government offers tax breaks for these electric cars for the most part. And I just have to question, you know, who's really paying that tax break, that, you know, rebate back to the buyer? Because I believe it must be the taxpayer. And if someone can afford a Tesla, I don't really think they're needing that incentive. And take my answer off there. But thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for your call. Jamie, aren't there places you can go online and sort of do a calculator, find out what the power source of your community is and
yeah.
what your mix is? Yeah.
Yeah, but actually, Neil, you and I have the same pet peeves. Like, there are a lot of times, you know, I'll talk to people who have EVs and they'll say, well, it's emission free. And I have to go, well, are you sure? You know, Paul, who called in earlier, who's getting all his power from, you know, solar power and charging his Leaf with that. Yeah, he's emissions free. But for a lot of people who get their power through coal fired plants, they're charging up those cars and they're saying they're emission free. And no, they're not. They're emission free kind of at the tailpipe is sort of the phrase that you hear bandied about a lot, which makes no sense. Because those cars don't actually have tailpipes. But that is a real concern. I think if you are really buying an electric car because you're committed to lowering your carbon footprint, you need to be making sure you're getting your electricity from a clean source, whether that's putting solar powers on your roof or, you know, working with the utility to find a clean source of energy to, you know, charge that car up with. And, you know, honestly, all the rest of the electricity you use as well. As for the tax breaks, I think Neil raises, you know, some really good points. You know, what are we subsidizing with these tax breaks for electric cars? But I think overall, you know, when you look at the impact that global climate change is having on us, if a tax break gets more people to adopt a cleaner form of driving, then I think the net benefit is good. I think sort of a larger issue that often gets swept under the rug with electric cars is these cars are using the roads, they're putting wear and tear on the roads, but they're not paying any gas taxes to maintain the roads. So I think, you know, our various state and local governments need to come up with ways to make sure that electric car drivers are paying their fair share for the infrastructure because, you know, they can cause potholes, they're causing wear and tear, they're causing traffic, but because they're not paying the gas tax like the rest of us, they're getting a free ride.
And that is a huge issue for AAA, isn't it? I know you're nonpartisan, but you want the roads to be in good shape.
We want the roads to be in good shape. And I think what we'll see is we'll see a VMT tax, a vehicle miles travel tax. So you'll pay similar to what you do with gasoline now. You'll just pay based on the amount of usage on the roads. So, yeah, you're skipping the gas tax. So you're not doing your fair share. You're wearing out the roads just like everybody else is, and you're not paying to help fix them. So
how will that work? Will you check in when you get your car registered every year and put your mileage in and
It could be that simple. It could be the car actually having some sort of reporting system built into it. But chances are it'll be just as simple as especially in a state where I live, where you do periodic vehicle inspection, your vehicle mileage gets recorded. So it can be based on something like that.
Mm. I want to bring up one more thing before I say goodbye to you. I have a Crain's Detroit Business article in front of me. An article from today, auto industry braces for Trump decision on steel. Jamie, is this something that you're following, how imports of aluminum and steel, specialty aluminum and steel, could affect the U.S. automakers?
Yeah, this is one of those things where it's just very clear there's no such thing as a free lunch. And, you know, what you do to help one set of workers and one side of the economy can have some pretty negative implications for the other ones. So, you know, basically what it comes down to is automakers use a lot of steel and aluminum from overseas because it's less expensive, because cars, you know, for consumers are already, you know, at the most expensive point they've ever been. I mean, the average cost of a new car now is well above $34,000. That's average. And so the reason that it's not higher is because a lot of these, you know, these new steel and aluminum materials that automakers are using, they're coming from overseas. And so the Trump administration is considering tariffs on steel, which could potentially launch a trade war with China being the biggest one, which could potentially make cars more expensive to produce, which, of course, means they'll be more expensive to buy. So, again, this is one of those things where, he's trying to protect one industry, but could potentially end up hurting another one. So it'll be very interesting to see how this plays out.
Do we have a sense of when we're going to hear?
I don't have a sense of when we're going to hear, no.
Okay. So we have just a few seconds left. Final parting words from John Paul. Hold on to your keys.
Hold on to your keys. Check the air in your tires. Make sure your tires are in good shape. If your battery's more than 5 years old, buy a new one.
There we go. Words of wisdom. Thank you both for being here, coming back regularly. John Paul, AAA's car doctor and senior manager of public affairs for AAA Northeast. Jamie Page Deaton, auto editor at U.S. News and World Report. John Keimel ran the board today. Dan Plummer answered your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling at mainecalling.net. Today's program will be rebroadcast this evening at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, join me and our tech team for the latest news from the world of personal computing devices. We will also discuss VPNs, virtual private networks, and what you need to know about setting up a VPN at home. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.